The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you know, a lot of people have asked about this program and what is it we're trying to do, but we live in an age of information. I mean, this has to be one of the most fascinating periods of time, both from a sociological and philosophical perspective, let alone technological and even scientific.
I'm remembering T.S. Eliot's quote, Kevin, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in information?"
There's such an overabundance of information, but such a lack of knowledge.
Well, and even driving beyond knowledge to a deeper place of understanding, I think what we are trying to do with this program and have from the beginning, and this isn't really something that we sort of set out to explain 2.5 years ago when we started this project, but it is to bring clarity and it is to elucidate truth to the greatest degree possible. And that is a challenging project. Mm-hmm. It assumes a lot of different things, Kevin, and we'll talk a little bit about this today. It assumes sort of a requisite humility, accepting that there's more that's unknown than is known. It assumes that we've got lots of questions to ask and not necessarily answers that we're going to discover now, and that all of life can't be reduced to simple truisms. But to the greatest degree possible, we still try to compress as much information as possible in a very short period of time. Yes, we live in an age of information, and things are changing. The implications are significant. You look at sociology, and you have new communities which exist today that didn't even 24 months ago.
And communities that don't even exist physically, but they're out in the e-land, you know, like Twitter and Facebook
and all the social media sites. And in fact, today, dating and courtship are no longer even by way of social connections and personal introductions. But, you know, you have these online communities and data-driven compatibility modeling. I mean, everything gets put through some sort of an interpretive grid and condensed by a computer into what makes the most sense for you. We've got games and competitions held from around the world in real time via the internet.
David, I play chess with my son every other night while he's at college, and he's 8 hours away.
So from a sociological perspective, information is revolutionizing the way we choose to live our lives. From a philosophical perspective, not to bore everyone with this, but the experiences of interacting with another person, they're now filtered by plastics and so many chips. Mm. And in even accessing a book that you may want to research on, or if you're writing a paper and you want to access a library, you've got databases thousands of miles away, which you can instantly tap into. And the strange thing, Kevin, is that it's no longer about leafing through a book and looking at actual tangible pages. Your decisions have more to do with how many pages do you want to print from a document, again, which is accessible from thousands and thousands of miles away.
Right.
Actually, Kevin, we access books and we don't even need access to the library itself. You can get all of that online. We have, I think, Kevin, what is most understandable in terms of the postmodern sort of labyrinthine abstraction of truth. A picture of a picture of a picture of a picture. Data is torn apart. It's reassembled. It's configured. Now, this is personal configuration for either your Mac or PC, and it's configured differently accordingly. It's configured for printing. It's compressed for emailing. It's transported virtually anywhere in the universe. And Kevin, remarkably, without so much as a wire. And this is reality with a small r, but this is reality. I still like to think of it as virtual reality, but this is also postmodernity at work.
And you know, David, it's not that all this information is necessarily even captured. You know, as of 2007, the capacity storage for the technology that's out there right now can't keep up with the information that's being created. So at this point, there's information being created, transferred, but a lot of it's just being lost into the ether as well.
Right. When you think of the technological implication of living in an age of information, it really is remarkable. The masses of data, the speed of processing, the accessibility to technology, the affordability of technology, it pervades our lives. And it is constantly progressing at even greater speeds. So, I mean, as I sit and think about an idea and write it down, Think of this, Kevin. It could be on a portable computer.
Yeah.
That wasn't possible even 25, 30 years ago. I remember having a laptop when I went to college. It didn't even have a mouse. There was no such thing as a mouse on a laptop.
Right.
I mean, with things that have progressed even in the last 15 to 20 years, we can sit and do work on a transportable computer and listen to digitized music from 1958, play that wirelessly throughout a house, and again, wires aren't even needed, except to power the implements that we happen to be using.
So your point is, I mean, the information accessibility is just overwhelming at this point. But even in the scientific, okay, I mean, let's take the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which started in 2000. In a few weeks, it collected more data than had been collected in all of astronomy up to that point. What do you do with it? I mean, is it something that people understand, or is it just an overwhelming access to info?
Well, and it does become a little bit overwhelming. The sheer quantity of data, they say now that an epidemiologist would have to spend 21 hours a day reading and studying just to stay current in his field.
Just to stay current. So we're talking someone who is a discoverer or a studier of diseases, just to stay on task, he's going to have to study 21 hours a day. Now, that leaves what? That leaves 3 hours for sleeping, eating, everything else that occurs.
Well, it is overwhelming, but the benefit, lifespans, birth survival rates, disease eradication, medical devices. Kevin, we have drugs to address every possible chronic ailment and then treat every unintended secondary malady. That's the kind of irony, is that there are always side effects to the cure. Science is allowing us to live longer and, in many cases, physically better than we would have without new scientific research and results. So technology, the age of information, which feeds into and speeds up the whole process of technological and scientific development, is astounding.
Well, you know, it reminds me of an Oscar Wilde quote. This is from 100 years ago. He says, it's a very sad thing that nowadays there's so little useless information. I mean, a lot of this we feel we have to have, too, just to function in this new society.
Right. Keep in mind, Kevin, our fascination with information, our fascination with data, in light of the weekly commentary, is simply this. Every week we embark on a new riddle to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing it with new inputs, with new data, with new questions every week. And the consolidation that goes on is immense. And that's what we want to explore today. How do we come up with what we come up with? And why? What is it important that we're looking for? What's the real purpose of the weekly commentary beyond improving someone's personal balance sheet and seeing greater success with an investment thesis, you know, seeing your 401k grow? That is actually very secondary. That may be the result of the process, but the process and what we're pursuing is absolutely vital.
Well, David, I wanted to say, too, you know, I've worked for this company now for 23 years, and oftentimes people have called in and said, where is it that you guys get all this information? I mean, how is it that you have the time to read as much as you do? And, you know, granted, David, you read a lot. Your dad reads a lot. Most of the guys and gals here read a lot and try to stay up with it. But there's a research staff that also goes into compiling this information, as well as many of the people that we've interviewed have research staffs as well. And so there seems to be a gathering in of this information. You're talking about what this show is about. Part of it has to do with just trying to make something that's very, very large into something that's smaller and easier to understand, is it not?
But we're not creating statistical inferences. This is not a computer model. We organize our lives around ideas that we hold to be true.
Mm-hmm.
There are recurrent themes and conversations for families, communities, states. These are ideas of realities which we live with, whether it's the idea of slavery, virtue, justice, duty, family,
mm-hmm.
government, time, tyranny. I mean, the things that you take for granted. These are the ideas that actually drive society, drive markets, and ultimately drive our understanding of reality. Ideas around which we organize ourselves, and we either thrive or suffer if the ideas are, in fact, bad. So the critical point, this is, I think, a very critical point to remember. Ideas have consequences,
mm-hmm.
and ideas which are unexamined still have consequences.
You know, we recently had a guest, David, that was talking about that with inflation. You know, talk about the consequence of not understanding what's going on. The inflation that's affected people's 401ks or the destruction of the dollar or the deflation. Those things can affect a 401k as one consequence. But if you live in a third world country, it may mean that you no longer eat. So we're talking about physical life and death consequences to information.
That's right, Kevin. So, I mean, coming back around to information and being in an information age, with all of the improvements to life generated by the information and the data which we gather, this data revolution, if you will, I have a question. Are we closer or farther away from wisdom?
Are we living more skillfully?
Correctly. And do we have more or less depth of understanding? Certainly we have breadth of information, that's data inputs from a trillion and ones, but do we have the most valuable information plucked from an infinite sea, organized coherently for sagacious living?
Yeah.
And by sagacity, I mean, you know, where someone can farsighted and in a discerning manner with practical judgment live and live well.
You know, David, I read a quote the other day that said, a wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. With all this information that we have, there seems to be a serious flaw embedded in the information universe.
Yeah, there is no way to automatically prioritize, sift, and analyze that information, Kevin, at the same time it's gathered. We're moving closer and closer to technology solving a part of that for us, but only a small part. We have algorithms and computer models that are now mapping our patterns of behavior. If you tap into the information superhighway, the internet, everything that you do is cataloged and mapped. And so think of this. We're now just beginning to create advertising models and data hierarchies which cater to an individual browser or technology user. It's amazing to me, Kevin, and frankly at times scary, the improvements that we've seen in data processing. But there's a last link. There's a last link, and this is what we question is really occurring as we see information and data continuing to be improved upon and increase in terms of volume, and it is this, the interpretation and analysis.
You know what it reminds me of when Pilate asked, what is truth? I mean, that's a very profound question. There's an awful lot of information out there, but where is the truth involved in that? What's that interpretation?
So if we're taking a little jaunt down a sort of data rabbit trail, or maybe it's even a dark rabbit hole, we think the answer is simple. We have very hectic schedules. Our calendars are packed. And with that comes a crux. How do we take the time to synthesize and think through the issues of our day and come up with a meaningful set of actions, proactive steps, after we've engaged all the data that we're exposed to, after we get to that interpretive piece?
Wouldn't it start with asking the right questions? I mean, oftentimes we're inundated with information when we really didn't ask the question in the first place.
Well, and again, why are we doing what we're doing on the weekly commentary? Having a filtration system which scans hundreds and even thousands of information sources and picks the jewels out of the rock pile, yeah, you've got to be able to ask the right questions up front. If you look at science, this is the question of first order or second order questions. Mm-hmm. First order questions are all the assumptions that you make coming into data analysis. Second order questions are the kinds of questions that someone working in a science lab asks when measuring things in a beaker and putting them on a Bunsen stove. Mm-hmm. You know, what chemicals are released when? I mean, those are second order questions when you're working in the lab. The first order questions determine the relevancy to begin with, and that's just one example, but always asking the right questions is a good place to start. Secondly, I think, Kevin, we have to reach beyond our own capacities and our own experiences to the best and brightest people in the world, and we've tried to do that in the commentary. This helps us construct a view of the world that has high-quality inputs, that has high-quality computations, and has internal integrity. And a part of that internal integrity is this, that we know when we're in over our heads.
Yeah.
We know when there is a limitation to the knowledge that we have, and that's, again, where we tap an expert and say, is this the right question? Is this the right assumption? Is this the right way to look at this set of current events? And we open it up for conversation.
You know, there's categories too, David, that we look at in the commentary. You know, we've talked about the financial, the economic, the political and the geopolitical. You know, in that 30 or 40 minute audio summary, a listener really, we have to try to cover that enough that they can ask the right questions. You were talking about first order questions versus second order questions. That's one of the things we're trying to nail down with the guests and with the interviews that we do.
So we gather, so we compress, we synthesize, we then interrelate, and then we come up with an expression of a view of where we're at and where we're going. And again, as you mentioned, Kevin, it's across disparate fields, although often overlapping and interrelated. Economics, finance, politics, geopolitics.
Right.
That's, I think, one of the things that is particularly fascinating to us, is to see how interconnected and interrelated the world is. You can't simply think in terms of the classes you may take in college. Economics is economics, and finance is finance, and politics is politics, and history is history. These are all a part of the same thing, the same fabric of reality that we're trying to understand more deeply.
Well, you know, David, you have told me in the middle part of the last century that Oxford University finally started figuring that out, and they created a program that combined the economic, the political. I mean, what was that degree program called?
It happens to be my favorite way of approaching a liberal arts education: philosophy, politics, and economics. Mm. Their PPE degree.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of other great programs at Oxford, but the PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics, what it does is it recognizes that all these things are interconnected. If you're going to study one, you have to study the others. And so I think, Kevin, at the end of the day, what we're trying to enable a listener to do is walk away from a 30 or 40 minute conversation and be the beneficiary of a gathered, compressed, synthesized, interrelated, and now simply expressed view of the world. Why is that important? It's important because you should be able to engage in the area of current events, thoughtfully engage friends, family members, and colleagues in an absolutely vital discussion. And that vital discussion, you may not put it in these terms or this particular category, but it is a discussion of the truth.
Well, and you're talking about engaging other people. I mean, what good is understanding and knowledge unless it can be duplicated and passed on, or at least acted on? I mean, there are a lot of people who are academics who really haven't done a doggone thing all their life, but they probably feel like they've got a lot of understanding. So the idea not only is compressing it, but showing someone how to take it and apply it and pass it on to someone else, is it not?
That's true, Kevin. And one of the important things of being able to take this and express it conversationally with friends, family members, and colleagues is this. We don't live in a neutral world. We don't live in a vacuum where information is somehow neutral. There is an interpretation being given. If you go to our governing authorities, if you go to our financial media, this is what we have: a twisting of data to convey what we would view as truths of convenience.
Mm-hmm.
When you twist data to create a truth of convenience, this is the kinds of truths which encourage re-election. You know, all systems go. GDP growth is positive.
Unemployment is dropping, even though it's dropping less than we thought it would be dropping.
We're seeing an improvement in retail sales, although the tax figures don't show that at all.
You know, right.
And again, that's what's left out. What we're looking for is an examination of what is true.
Yeah.
And, frankly, what is also on the other side of that unmitigated balderdash. So if a client, if a listener can walk away and more critically listen to the news, more critically, in an additive fashion, contribute something to a conversation around the water cooler at the office, that is fantastic. If they can discern the truths, and instead of being sucked into social elation on the other side of being manipulated by the powers that be, if they can unmask the current Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers and the unemployment numbers, which are massaged to death, if they can see reality, whether it's financial, economic, political, if they can see reality, I think we've done a little bit of our job, at least in terms of asking questions and encouraging people to pursue that very thing.
Well, information is ubiquitous. It's all around us. Understanding is a rare commodity. And let's just go back, though, and say, how do we approach this, David? I mean, you have to have humility when you're approaching information. If you're looking at a system and you think you've already figured it out ahead of time, there's very little to learn because the cup's already full. Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
Madam Murray O'Hare had a great debate with a Christian many years ago, and it came to a point in the debate where the question was asked, Ms. O'Hare, how much of the world's information do you think you have access to? And she said, oh, at least 1 or 2%. And that's a lot of information to have in your brain. And the question was then asked, and again, this is from a Christian perspective, then do you think God's existence could be in the other 98%? And so I think whenever you're pursuing, whatever you're pursuing, in whatever field you're pursuing, you have to know that there is more that is unknown than is known. And that is a form of humility. So questions all of a sudden become front and center, and an openness to dialogue has to exist. This is the point of why we have people on our program who may agree with us and may disagree with us, that where there may be things that in their analysis we part company. In other regards, we overlap completely.
Yeah.
We're not interested in duplicating ourselves. We're interested in having a better understanding of the truth. And if that comes from taking a multi-perspectival approach, again, where clarity comes on the other side of sort of us putting out a thesis, here's what we think, what do you think? And them coming back and saying, well, possibly, but not possibly. And on the other side of antithesis, coming up with sort of a synthesized knowledge.
Well, speaking of the need for that synthesis, you know, we've said the problem is we face way too much data with too little time. I mean, we all run out of the end of the day too quick. And recently read that the human brain, on average, can keep about 7 pieces of information in short-term memory. And really, it can only hold in memory 4 relationships at that same time. So, you know, you think of this wealth of information, but in reality, if you don't have synthesis, if you don't have some sort of compression on it, then you're going to have to, you're overwhelmed.
It reminds me, Kevin, that as we try to discern trends and anticipate transitions within the financial markets, this is one of the reasons why it's a significant effort. As you say, there's only 4 interrelated categories which someone can hold in their brain at any one time, and yet it is these interrelated elements in various fields which are vital to seeing, for instance, the unintended consequences of policy measures.
Right.
And we get to be witness to that this year, next year, as we have over the last few years, things that are done right and things that are done wrong to either exacerbate the current crisis we're in and have been in for several years now, or actually solve the problems.
Well, and you know, as far as 4 categories go, you've been very consistent, David, from 2008 to 2009 to 2010. The financial, that was a 2008 phenomenon. It hasn't gone away, but it moved to the economic in 2009 and then to the political this year. I mean, that's one of the things we've talked about, how much Washington really affects and policymaking affects decisions, ultimately translating to the worldwide or the geopolitical. Now, those are 4 relationship categories that the show tries to cover on a weekly basis, to some degree maybe emphasizing one over the other, at least on, you know, at certain times.
And so again, why do we do what we do with the weekly commentary? Kevin, if we didn't do this publicly, we would still be doing this privately, because we still have to prioritize and compress information to come up with those jewels upon which we can make wise decisions.
Well, and that's what the show is all about. I mean, we have done this all the years, the couple of decades that I've been here. We've done this on our own. I've just wished multiple times that we had other people who could be flies on the wall to listen to the discussion, because there's a lot of interesting ideas, not necessarily always right, but interesting ideas that get processed.
Now, I think one of the challenges for our listeners is this. We do ask a lot of questions, and we don't always come up with a solution or an answer. And that
right.
does create a natural tension, something that I think the human spirit is not particularly comfortable with on
right.
any given day. Living with tension and living with something that kind of hangs out there unanswered and perhaps unanswerable.
Well, some of the facts are emotionally uncomfortable, David. And that's, you know, if a person has not gotten to the point where they can live and analyze with emotionally uncomfortable thoughts, then they may as well just go back and watch American Idol again.
And I think, Kevin, that's why CNBC is such a great fit for the modern mind, because we are not a hardy people.
Yeah.
We do not have minds that can disconnect somewhat and engage risk from the standpoint of a theoretical notion and come up with ways to manage it. Because risk, things that can go wrong, things that are variables that would impair your finances in the future, these are not things that people necessarily want to engage. They'd rather think about the next soccer game, taking their kids to an ice skating competition,
sure.
watching a football game.
And there's really nothing wrong with that as long as you have gotten yourself out of harm's way or made the right decisions on the things that are important to keeping that security.
Right, and CNBC caters to this in that they tell you exactly what you want to hear,
yeah.
which is everything is okay. We have all things under control. Things are only getting better from here. And guess what? You don't have to connect with this data and information because we already have it well in hand. Just trust your financial advisor, and he has done the adequate preparation to make sure that you can achieve your financial goals.
Well, and when I think about financial risk or political risk or economic risk, Dave, I have to think about the difference between real risk and real reward versus the way we're manipulated oftentimes. You remember Naomi Wolf when we talked to her back, I think it was November. She was talking about how when society is to be moved a certain direction, they're going to create an external and an internal risk that makes society, you know, move the same direction.
I mean, it's no different when you're looking at things in the marketplace, Kevin. Exogenous and endogenous risks, things that are either lurking on the balance sheet of a company waiting to explode, or policy measures, exogenous, which may impact a company and impair their profitability. For instance, the greenhouse gas tax, which, as we mentioned several weeks ago, would cost Valero $6 billion out of $7 billion of profit that they made this last year.
Right.
Again, that is an exogenous risk, policy driven, and could cause them to either close their doors as a company, or we could see the price of gas, that which they process and refine, at $8, $9, $10 a gallon. Is that really what we're trying to do with greenhouse gases? No. But all that to say, exogenous risks, external risks, or endogenous risks, internal risks, are realities within the world of finance. They're also realities within the world of politics. And here's what we're asking people to do. If you can think beyond, if you can critically engage issues today, then you are not like, say, for instance, if you go diving, a school of fish
yeah.
who can react or overreact to every movement. You may not be trying to kill the school of fish as you point at them to your diving partner. And what do you see? You
or
see,
like you said, clear your mask, possibly.
Right, yeah, but you do see a mass reaction, and every fish re-diverts and goes a different direction on the basis of one small movement. Whether it's Naomi Wolf saying that these kinds of threats can be created, yeah. internal or external, and they do, in fact, cause a reaction amongst people.
Yeah, but that whole school of fish may be going right into a net. That's the real threat that someone should have talked to them about.
So coming back to either a sociological analysis, a political analysis, or a financial and economic analysis, if you're not aware of the real issues, if you're not engaged with the real issues, and if you're only gathering data from a CNBC who's telling you exactly what you want to hear, you do have an issue.
Yeah.
You're exactly like the school of fish.
Well, and it takes critical thinking skills. That's something that we all need to employ more of. Now, wisdom is from a multitude of counselors. You know, one of the things that we've had come up in the past is, why did you interview that guest? We don't even agree with that guest. Why did you ask what you asked?
Well, this may be annoying to some of our listeners, but I just have to invite you to entertain this idea. Is there something that we can benefit as a capitalist system?
Right.
Is there some benefit that we can glean from reading a Marxist critique of capitalism? Is there something that we can glean from reading or entertaining the ideas of a Saul Alinsky? Yes.
Yeah.
Looking at the strategy and tactics applied on the street here in the United States.
Right.
Again, sort of a filtered Marxism. Does it pay to take a different view? Does it pay to, for instance, even though in the grand scheme, Kevin, you and I think, conclude that we're headed towards a massive inflation? Do we want to line up a bunch of inflation and just confirm our view?
That way we're all nodding the same and going right down the same road.
And maybe unaware that we're all insane.
Right.
Or can we and should we bring someone in, perhaps the best person, to pick that apart and say, no, in fact, we're in the worst deflation of our lifetimes. We need to hear the best arguments on either side, I think, to come up with the truth.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, honestly, even to the point of looking at sort of the critical nature of Nietzsche, he tore Christianity apart. Why? what were his criticisms? What were the things that, that he looked at as, you know, the power structures within the church which he thought were illegitimate?
Is there a value to that observation as a Christian?
Correct. Right. So again, it, regardless of the worldview you come from, does it pay, is it healthy in the pursuit of wisdom to find a multitude of counselors? Not necessarily ones that you agree with, but those whom will engage with you in conversation and help you come closer to the truth on the other side.
All right. Now, there's a lot of people who don't necessarily buy into that. We live in an age of technology right now where there's a reliance on statistics and numbers. You know, this very financial crisis that we're in right now was based on models that they thought were sound, airtight, and really didn't necessarily need human wisdom. And we're talking the derivatives collapse, the financial collapse. I think of a quote that just came out from Edward Felton from Princeton University. He says, "Understanding," in quotations, "turns out to be overrated, and statistical analysis goes a long way." How do you feel about that?
Well, that's the point. That's the point, is that we have a whole world which is moving towards data and information and assumes that if you have the right computer models, you can synthesize and create inferences from the data that you have and come up with something that is meaningful.
Right.
And that is what I would question. You do come up with something. The question is how meaningful and how significant it is.
Well, it takes us to an undue faith in constructs or models. I mean, these are models that may have worked for a certain data set at a certain time in a controlled environment.
Well, and you look at long-term capital management,
yeah,
and that's perhaps worth pondering. 1998, it was only MIT mathematicians and physicists, and they came up with the perfect model to measure risk and volatility, and guess what? Their data set only went back 10 years.
Or these 20, were guys
it may
that
have been 15 years, but it was a limited time frame, and so they didn't have volatility measures that accommodated major swings in the market because their data set was inadequate. And yet these were the best and the brightest. Whether it's LTCM, quant trading, high-frequency trading, Kevin, it's the idea that somehow we are coming closer to the truth, synthesizing mass amounts of data, and we can do that through a computer instead of through a mind. And we would disagree with that. We would say that human intelligence, not that we're a bunch of Luddites who don't have iPhones and don't have computer chips in our cars. I mean, we are too beneficiaries of the modern day of technology and love it and are appreciative of it. But to assume that wisdom comes from data, I don't know that that's correct. And to assume that understanding comes from a computer program, I don't know that that is in fact true. And this is one of the reasons why, if you go back to Nassim Taleb's book, The Black Swan,
right,
what you have is here he described this statistical analysis where most events, commonly occurring non-crisis events, occur right in the middle of this bell-shaped curve. And you have a few things out on the edge of the bell-shaped curve which are very uncommon.
What they call that, the fat tail.
Correct.
Right.
These are multi-standard deviation events, 2, 3, 4, 6 standard deviation events from that midpoint on the Gaussian
which
curve.
Which means they should rarely, if ever, occur.
And yet, in the last 2 years, we've packed in enough of these rare events to take care of the last 2,000 years and the next 2,000 years of weird events.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. Statistics does not determine reality.
Right.
It does not. And to assume that a mathematical model is something that we can put faith in, again, we are moving because of the information deluge, because of the information revolution that we're in the midst of, Kevin, we are moving towards a place where we are even more dependent on data gathering by computers, synthesis by computers, and meaning being determined by computers. And I think this is why we are prone to crisis after crisis after crisis, year after year after year.
Well, wouldn't you say, David, that the compression of this information, you need to do it in a truthful way. In other words, something that's not just idealistic. This compression of information or understanding sometimes can take on a very simple discipline. You know, I'm thinking about the triangle right now. People look at the entire investment market out there. They wonder, they'll hear that tech stocks are going up. So since their neighbor, Bill, did well in tech stocks, they'll go buy tech stocks. Boom, it crashes. Since their neighbor, Jane, did really well in real estate, they'll run over to the next bubble. But there seems to not be discipline in this compression of all this information. And again, I think of the triangle because in the last couple of decades here at this company, that's been a discipline, whether gold was going up or down, the stock market was going up or down, cash was either holding value or losing value. I mean, don't you feel that the triangle is a good example of an algorithm or a compression that seems to produce useful outcomes?
It is. The one qualifier I would put on there, and I think the distinction I would make between a computer-generated model and one generated by minds, is that minds can come a little bit closer to accommodating the vagaries of the market, which have to do with the human spirit. There's a whole field of study called behavioral finance. And behavioral finance are all the exceptions to the rules. We assume that the efficient market theory, the efficient market hypothesis is valid. We assume that there is rational behavior, that people do the right thing at the right time and not the wrong thing at the wrong time. So what you have is an acknowledgement in the field of behavioral finance where actually the rules get broken all the time. Illogical behavior is as much a part of reality as logical behavior. And you can't really put that into an algorithm. And this is why, again, we assume that things are mappable, and they are, until they aren't. And this is why we have problems within the financial system today. I look at Oliver Wendell Holmes, Kevin, and he said, I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And that's basically, Kevin, I think what we try to do, whether it's with the commentary or on the other side of something as simple as the perspective triangle, mm-hmm. The perspective triangle is almost cliche in its simplicity. It is one-dimensional. It is small enough and simple enough for a child to draw. It is a shape
right.
with a few colors. But it is not simple. It is, in fact, very complex. We've come to it on the other side of a huge amount of information processing and 40 years of experience in the financial markets to say that this kind of a balance works. Now, we can elaborate on that. If it's liquidity strategies and cash management strategies, if it's growth and income strategies in an environment where you're either above or below the rate of inflation in terms of real rates of return, positive or negative, there are strategies that work. Again, you can expand this out to a very complex conversation in a very detailed organization of facts that line up with an individual investor's needs.
Well, you know, to reiterate the triangle for the new listener, I know our regular listeners have been using the triangle or have heard the triangle many times, but the triangle is just simply a base built on precious metals and gold of about a third. The left side of the triangle would be, you know, growth and income, what most people think of as stocks and bonds. And then the right side of the triangle is just simply the cash liquidity that allows you to let the other two sides do what they do.
So I guess in conclusion, Kevin, whenever you're analyzing data and information, it's not something that I think can be left to a computer model.
Yeah.
Computer models don't take into account history as adequately as they need to. Computer models don't take into account the human mind and the human heart and human behavior as adequately as they need to in order to predict the future and to become our newest and latest crystal ball. I think, Kevin, what we need is people engaged with the process. People who are thoughtfully considering the ideas behind the facts, the ideas that make those facts relevant, that make the data significant, and make the data something that actually impacts the course of human history. This is what we'd love to see in the context of our listenership, people who are utterly engaged in a conversation. Not necessarily with the idea that truth is predetermined or that truth is even knowable, but we are trying to have a better understanding of the truth, and thus we have a conversation. You and I have a conversation every week. We invite guests into that same conversation every week. We invite our listeners into this conversation critically. This is one of the reasons why we have Q&As, question and answer, each year with our listeners. We want to engage you as we hope you engage the world in which we live thoughtfully, so that we can all live well and more skillfully.
Asking the right questions in humility, not knowing the answer ahead of time necessarily, but still pursuing those questions as far as we possibly can. You know, it reminds me, didn't Sir Francis Bacon say something on that subject?
If a man should begin in certainties, he will end in doubts. But if you are content to begin with doubts, you will end in certainties.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.